If you're a big, strong, smart, rich guy who's super well connected, how can you not be mafia? How can you not be when everyone wants to know you? Who doesn't want to know the kickboxing world champion walks into a club with 20 big booty cuties? Everyone wants to know me. The mafia want to know me. So I don't need to be mafia if all my friends are mafia.
We inevitably and must see the world through the lens of a story. A story is a description of the implicit structure through which we view the world and prioritize our perceptions and determine how to act. Now, because you can act in a very large variety of ways, that plethora of possibility has to be limited and focused. It has to come to a point. It has to have a destination. It has to have a moral. It has to have an ethic. And what a story is a description of an ethic of attentional and action prioritization.
The publisher of Prince Harry's new memoir says it is selling at a record-setting pace, and record is the word. Listen to this numbers. Readers bought more than 1.4 million copies of Spare on the first day it was published last week. That's huge. The book is still making headlines. I read it this weekend. It's worth a read, even for Harry's brief comment that his family made a fortune from the slave trade. That fact, is generating a whole lot of talk about a very disturbing part of the monarchy's very long history.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Peter Gumley back on the show. Pete, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Tim. It's an honor to be back on Our Interesting Times. I'm counting my blessings. 2023 is shaping up to be an interesting one. And I think there are lots of hopeful signs.
Well, we can only hope. it's hard to know what to expect because those who think they're in control seem to be dedicated to making the world, I guess, much more complicated and much more, challenging than it need be. But that's how they stay in business, I guess you could say. So today you wanted to talk about this whole thing. Well, one thing is this character Andrew Tate, and this whole thing with Harry and Meghan, right? Prince yep. Harry, he's still yep. Prince.
Our latest British export over there.
And you want to see some of this drama that's played out for the public to see, to take in as sort of a controlled dialectic. But I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, I guess, so just to situate these characters that are presented to us on our airwaves all across both mainstream media and independent media, actually. I think I'd first like to just discuss the growth of independent media and indeed the growth of podcasting itself, which I guess seems a little bit meta to discuss on a podcast, but I think this is the context in which the rise of these alternative figures for meta political purposes on behalf of the oligarchs is occurring. And I'm going to argue that generally these figures are presented to us and are promoted for the purposes of distracting people and for herding and containing potential opposition to their grand project, namely the NWO, what I call anti-Christendom, the coagulation of this civilization, this social architecture of the demonic that they are trying to construct. And they do this through this psychodrama, through this mass manipulation. So first of all, on the rise of the podcast as a medium, it's a quiet phenomena necessarily, because you might not notice so much how much people are tuning in to this form of audio content. But, you know, it's not only on trains and going around supermarkets, but in the office, at home, people are increasingly tuning in to this medium. What it's doing to people's brain with the electromagnetic frequencies, with the ear pods and things, is that we've yet to find out. But, you know, we're increasingly in these kind of self-sealed cells. And I'm going to suggest that this is something that has not gone unnoticed by the powers that be. There's an article here from Reuters. So, I mean, about as mainstream as you can come, from June last year, that said that a growing number of people are selectively avoiding important news stories, such as the coronavirus so-called pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, according to a report released on Tuesday. The majority of people surveyed continued to consume news regularly, but 38% said they often or sometimes avoid the news, up from 29% in 2017. The Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism said in its annual digital news report, around 36%, particularly those under 35s, said that the news lowers their mood. gee, you don't say. So we've got this context that basically trust in the regime media is declining and is lowest in the United States. On average, 42% of people said they trust most news most of the time. And that's a figure that's fallen in almost half the countries in the report from 2017 to 2022. You've mentioned before, your interlocutor Joe Atwill on Powers and Principalities has mentioned that for the 2021 Academy Awards viewing, the viewership collapsed to a once unthinkable barely 10 million viewers, less than half the 23.6 million who had watched a year earlier. The oligarchs have access to far more information than we're privy to. And so they are noticing these trends of disengagement from the overt regime media, which was so effective in conditioning the silent generation, the baby boomer generation and Generation X. This is sometimes what's been called the boomer truth regime. But this created the very framing, the very water in which people navigated their social and political lives, and indeed the sort of parameters of their psychology and their political opinion. This set the Overton window. And we've got all this evidence here that millennials in particular, Generation Z, are disengaging or not even ever engaging from with the regime media. They're looking for alternative sources.
This perhaps could explain the big push for censorship now.
Yes. So there's a carrot and stick approach.
Because you could give lip service to the First Amendment when everyone was programmed properly. Right? If everyone's brainwashed, free speech is fine. The moment people start going off script and asking difficult questions and saying things that don't go along with the script, then you have to clamp down, you know, remove the velvet off the hammer, so to speak.
Yeah, that's one of their methodologies of control, but it's not the only one. And I think that's an important thing to bear in mind here, that they do things for multiple reasons, and they don't just have a plan A, they have a plan B, a plan C. and they notice what kind of segments of political discourse people are drawn to, and they make contingency plans and provisions for each of those segments in order to have this full spectrum dominance, which is most conducive to the construction of their anti-Christendom.
That's their term, by the way. So,
which term is that? Sorry,
full spectrum dominance.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, think... yeah. Maybe. Yeah. So that's what I want to emphasize is that's right across the independent alternative space as well, and that's where I'm going to recommend precaution from our listeners in their kind of in the way that we perhaps approach discourse in these areas. I think we all know to avoid CNN and the BBC, for example, but I'm going to suggest that we bring some of that skepticism to other channels, things like InfoWars, Fox News, GB News, etc. So these podcasts, then, they can be found on all sorts of topics, but I'm interested particularly in those that deal with political issues, and those that appeal to young men, because it's young men that shape society. Or come to shape society. It's men that shape society. Women largely follow. And the reason that we have such feminist discourse today is because men have allowed it. The oligarchs obviously have promoted it for their own particular ends. And so young men are tuning in to podcasts like Joe Rogan, which follow a number of kind of cliche topics. Things like self-improvement. I think the most popular YouTube videos for men are self-improvement videos. The most popular YouTube videos for women are makeup tutorials. So in a certain sense, it's kind of similar thing. Yes, they touch on these topics, meditation, psychedelic drugs, and martial arts, cryptocurrency, conspiracy, esoteric philosophy. And some things just come up again and again. It's kind of a bit of a trope now, but things like Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey, ayahuasca, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And, you know, these things are of varying value. I mean, I think, you know, the rise of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is probably a good thing. Other things are less wholesome. So this comes from this disengagement from regime media, but it also comes about as a result of the amount of time people spend commuting. And the growing loneliness and atomization in our society as the oligarchs continue to desiccate the social fabric. So podcast insights reveal that we listen to our podcasts 49% at home, 22% in the car. They have an ability, in other words, to fit into our busy lives like no other medium. I'm drawing some of these notes, by the way, from an article that I'm writing on the rise of the podcast. But I think what none of these other commentators perhaps noting about the podcast is that its value is also as what someone called a cozy friendship simulator. They fulfill this role of sort of almost providing a kind of you know, surrogate friendship that you can just plug into at any time. And particularly during lockdowns, for example, for Zoomers, in the absence of a sort of, you know, or the decline of family and kinship, people, man is a social animal. And so people plug into these podcasts to have on the background and feel less lonely. I'm also seeing podcasts, interestingly, as a kind of a transition away from literacy towards orality. And this is kind of a reverse of something that happened after the invention of the printing press in the early modern period. We've got here basically people starting to return to oral tradition. And oral tradition was always tied to the wisdom tradition. The village gathered around the the bonfire in summer and listening to sage wisdom from the village elder, there's some instinct within us that wants to gather around the hearth in the drinking hall or whatever and hear from our elders. And that's why I think that's connected to why podcasts seem to explore these questions of meaning. And we're going to get on to Dr. Jordan Peterson, who is a big figure in this area. 50% of monthly US podcast listeners are aged between 12 and 34, 43% between 35 and 54 years old, and 22% are aged over 55. So there's a broad typology here. Boomers are still watching TV. Gen X are kind of somewhere split. Millennials and Zoomers are getting their information from online. So as I say, as there's a decline in anything insightful from mainstream media, the oligarchs are noticing this. They're noticing this growth, and they're going to take steps to mitigate any threat and shape the herd consciousness in the direction of their new world order. So to take the most prominent one here that I've mentioned, Joe Rogan. Now, I had no idea, Tim, quite how enormously popular this podcast is. It's actually the most popular entertainment product, full stop, in the world. It's more popular than any TV show, any film, any sporting event that's going on. It typically averages 11 million listeners per episode. So it's hugely influential in shaping people's opinions, particularly millennials and Zoomers. Now, I'm drawing this research from a YouTube channel called Leather Apron Club, who has done very granular and careful study of some of these podcasts. And his analysis showed that 42% of Rogan's political guests are ethnically Jewish. Now that's a high percentage, given the size of that population, the general US population. But if you analyze the percentage of guests that have had their episodes scrubbed from YouTube or Spotify, we both experienced that. I think you'll find that Rogan's kind of Semitic guests are much less likely to have had an episode withdrawn. And these guests that he has on, huge number of them, but they're people like Sam Harris, people like Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson. They make up, another one is, what's his name? A gay Jewish chap who is getting promoted a lot.
Rubin,
Dave Rubin. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
He's adopting two. Yeah. David, two surrogate babies.
Yeah. Very sinister.
Yes. And that's being normalized, by the way, in the, yeah. Among the right, which is very distressing.
That's what I want to come on to. So they form this group. It's called the Intellectual Dark Web. And they are basically like the officially approved kind of milieu that they want to draw people who would otherwise be suspicious or opposing, hostile.
It's funny. I don't know if this wasn't a story when you suggested this topic, but just recently, Steven Crowder had a dispute with Daily Wire, his contract, and there's different interpretations of it, but it factors into this because that's obviously controlled opposition. But I just was listening to E. Michael Jones talk about it. He was saying how Crowder, because he's a conservative, is too stupid to understand he's dealing with a group, a category. He doesn't understand the problem of his business relationship is much deeper than simply a dispute over money. It's also the understanding what real wealth is and how they use money to actually steal wealth, more or less, through egregious contracts and also usury. But I'm sorry, but it's kind of like I was just listening to something earlier this morning about this and it's just that brought that to mind. I'll let you continue.
No, please jump in whenever you like. You're quite right. This is why I think it's such a pertinent issue, and to say that he's stupid I think is the charitable description. I think these people ultimately they're either fools or they're knaves.
Yeah,
any other option is kind of excluded when you consider the evidence in its totality. And I'm going to present at least some of that today. Another figure, which I think shows how the regime is noticing the growth in this independent media space and is astroturfing figures and the kind of technological tools and levers that they can pull in order to create artificial amplification of a particular figure's message is this Jewish MIT researcher, Lex Fridman. Yeah. Lex Fridman, who has popped up onto the scene seemingly out of nowhere and has 2.59 million subscribers. He himself comes from an academic family background. He first worked at Google on AI for 6 months before then going to work as at MIT as an AI researcher. He launched his podcast in 2018. And within the first 20 episodes of his podcast, he had a number of big name guests, including Elon Musk, Eric Schmidt, the old CEO of Google, Steven Pinker. And this channel, Leather Apron Club, found that 25% of his guests overall and 70% of his political guests are ethnically Jewish. And I think his rise is so clearly artificial that you can start to see some of the techniques that the enemies of Christian civilization are going to employ or are employing to fill this alternative stroke dissident right wing space. You can see why he's the most recommended podcaster on YouTube. It seems that every time a video you watch to the end, he's the next one on autoplayed. You look at his comments and it's just pretty strange. There's very few organic seeming comments. You'll see things like, "Thanks, Lex. This is a true meeting of great minds." So I think we're starting to see here the rise of bots.
Yeah.
As a way to inflate the grassroots popularity of particular dissident figures or people who are marketed as dissident figures. Now, the reason that one is suspicious, that he has all these prominent figures straight out of the gate, but also he's got an incredibly boring, monotone delivery.
That's what I've heard. I've never listened to his podcast, but I've heard his name come up. Some people have suggested he himself might be like artificial intelligence.
He, like Elon Musk, he's got this kind of this intonation and this inflection in his voice, which it is robotic. And I don't know, it's part of this promotion of transhumanism where both machines become more like men and men become more like machines, and they're acting to try and make themselves seem more machine-like and guide people into this egregore herd consciousness. That's a whole nother thing. The fact that he's pushed so hard in the recommendations, he's had Bishop Barron on, who's this kind of, a Catholic podcast intellectual YouTube figure. I think it's very clear from the beginning he is a psyop, this chap, Fridman. A lot of people know about him, but they've not actually watched him, as like yourself. So it seems like a large portion of those subscribers perhaps are bots.
Same with Joe Rogan. I've never watched a Joe Rogan program.
Right.
Because to me, it's low hanging fruit for the most part at best.
Yeah.
So, although, occasionally when he started questioning things like the vaccines, it became interesting because you had a notable figure getting involved in the controversy, but.
Yeah, after people, though, have received the poison into their arms.
Yeah.
So it's a fait accompli. And this is the metapolitics of it. Our friend Dr. Jesse Russell has talked about how the conservative movement, generally speaking, during the post-war, post-Second World War, Cold War period, was designed as a kind of holding pen, where they knew that there was going to be a significant segment of the American population and in other Western nations, who were opposed to the Cultural Revolution, the destruction of the family, the decline in ownership, the destruction of manufacturing, all these currents and trends that we've seen. And they needed to be corralled and they needed to be managed. And the conservative figures like William F. Buckley, like, you know, various Republican candidates, British Conservative Party candidates, Thatcher and so on, were given to us as a way to articulate those grievances and concerns, but also to limit them from any further inquiry or any further intellectual or spiritual development of those, of the roots of those problems. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. It's just a new phase of it. It's a common theme with synagogue stroke CIA pushed content on YouTube. Back when PragerU came completely out of nowhere, it starts getting shared and promoted a lot, gets a lot of subscribers, and starts, as you say, by producing some quite resonant content.
About, oh yeah, like Daily Wire, you know, with Matt Walsh's
political correctness and
with transgender stuff. You know, what is a woman and this stuff? But it's always, it only goes so far.
It only goes so far on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, seemingly every other video is talking about the chosen people and how we need to give money to Israel and, you know, democracy in the Middle East. And, you know, if you bless Israel, God will bless you, and anti-Semitism bad, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the metapolitics. It's about herding. It's about containing. It's about distracting. Now, without sort of getting too biographical, I used to work in a very low ranking civil service position in the UK. And as part of that, I saw a little bit of some of the approaches that government takes to profiling the population. And I guess one could deduce that what I was seeing on that very low rung was much more prominent or was very much used as a method higher up, and of course into the intelligence agencies, the secret societies as a whole. So what you see is a kind of psychographic profiling where through typologies, they segment the masses into different groups with different psychographical triggers and things that, you know, appeals, and they know how to appeal to each of those demographics, right? So
hey, this was pretty much admitted, that series Century of the Self, Adam Curtis, I think, is the are you familiar with Adam Curtis? I think
yes, yeah, number yeah. of good documentaries, yeah.
Yeah, he talks about openly how this was done in the late 60s and 70s, where for the first time, political parties started finding out what appealed to people, and that formed their agenda, or at least what they told people they supported, as opposed to presenting a platform and making the argument in the platform itself. They'd find out what the people wanted, then frame the message based on that. It's obvious that that's completely different. But this was, of course, facilitated, or at least made possible by the age of the computers, you know, with mass data collection and monitoring and collecting and these things. And this factor in not only the marketing of consumer items, but the marketing of politics as well, too. And it fundamentally changes the idea of political leadership, what a democracy is. Because at what happens is the people's passions, their insecurities, you know, whatever, are being manipulated. It's a completely different relationship.
Yeah, and you know, what do you think these 17 intelligence agencies are doing all day? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's an incredibly sophisticated and wide, you know, large scale operation here. This psychographic profiling.
Yeah, and with, of course, the digital age where everything is online, all that data can be swooped up.
Yeah, right? All that intelligence collect is done for free.
Yeah, metadata, they call it. Yeah. Metadata.
Exactly. And so they know that there are Telegram, you know, messages, groups and WhatsApp groups where people are talking about died suddenly and about Klaus Schwab.
Mm-hmm.
And about Drag Queen Story Hour, and about how people can't afford to live in their own, indigenous towns and cities anymore, and about immigrant crime and so on. They know all of this. They're collecting all of that. And so they create figures and outlets and intellectual discourse spaces to appeal and to cater to those various segments of the population, because they know that they are the greatest potential hindrance and stumbling block to their new world order. And so they needed to be herded, and they needed to be contained, need to be distracted. And in my mind, that's what someone like the obnoxious figure of Andrew Tate is there to do. And also these farcical soap operas like the Prince Harry and Meghan melodrama is therefore why it's being so relentlessly promoted by regime media at the moment. And indeed, I would say Kanye West as well, actually. You might disagree, but I thought Kanye West, I was quite supportive of, and quite pleased to see him talking about the red media and spreading all sorts of pertinent and useful information into dissident spaces and fairly mainstream spaces. But then when I saw that absolutely ridiculous appearance on Alex Jones wearing a Balenciaga face mask saying, "I love Hitler, I love Jews, I'm a Nazi, I'm a Jew," absolutely crystal clear that he is some kind of, psyop there, that designed to basically depict anyone who even questions Jewish power as mentally unstable and crazy and a Nazi. He's sort of fulfilling, you could say, the position of the holy fool, which is a tarot card that kind of breaks open categories and vessels and uses that kind of comedic switchblade to cause a kind of a further desiccation of discourse and traditional forms. So I'm going to share a recent a debate from the mother of parliaments here in Westminster, and just give you a sense of what kind of things absorbs the political oxygen at the moment. And I'm sure it's very similar in the United States.
I had an experience recently in a restaurant where a man dressed as a woman walked into the toilet.
So this is a Conservative MP, Miriam Cates, in the parliamentary chamber.
On my own in the toilets, he stood behind me and stared at me into the mirror, looking at me in my eyes. Now, I have no idea if he intended me any harm. But my evolved instinct as a woman was to be frightened, because unlike almost any other species, women are far less powerful than men. We can't defend ourselves. That's why we have... No, it's a fact. The difference in strength between men and women is phenomenal. That's why we have separate sex categories for sport. Women are evolved to be wary of men in intimate spaces. That's why we have single-sex spaces. They must continue to exist for the safety and privacy of women. This threatens that social contract. Finally, it threatens the understanding of our law, which should be based on fact. And you cannot change your sex any more than you can change your place of birth or who your parents are. Now, I fully understand the complex arguments involved in this, and we should treat it with compassion. But if the law is not based on fact, then how can we trust the law? That is why the government is absolutely right to serve this notice.
Order. Lloyd Russell Boyle.
Goodness me, that speech was probably one of the worst transphobic dog whistle speeches that I've heard in an awful long time. The idea of linking trans people with predators, frankly, is disgusting, and you should be ashamed.
No, calm down. Yes.
No. Way to you or anyone else, to the honourable member, Now, on the substance of this, ignoring that horrible speech that we have just heard, actually...
Order, Peter Bottomley.
Did the chair hear anything transphobic in the previous speech.
So I'll stop it there. But I think, you know, that gives you a sense of what political discourse is reduced to now. It's humiliating, it's gay, and it's stupid, and it's fake. Mm-hmm. But while we have this, you know, huge increase in excess deaths, the beginning of a demographic death spiral, a sovereign debt crisis, increasing illiteracy, increasing crime, the end of the consumer bourgeois paradigm. This is the kind of discourse which absorbs the public attention, and it's designed to. And as I say, this is the venerable institution of Parliament, which was originally established with the inspiration of the Catholic Church, and was a way by which the Commons could, through their relationship of feudalism with their lords and with ultimately the king, could give counsel for purposes largely of aid and taxation. And this is what it's reduced to now. So it's this kind of humiliation. And you can see there the dialectic. Those are the kind of permitted positions on this trans issue. So you had the Conservative MP first, and you could see she was kind of opposing it, but she was also saying it is a complex issue and we need to be compassionate and sensitive. And you might have also picked out she was promoting the evolution hoax and the social contract hoax as well. And then you had the just ridiculous out and out globo homo clown world Labour MP there, saying that this was that she was basically Hitler. So that's the sort of dialectic that we're given at the moment.
I like it, sort of the casual use of this new word, transphobic.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Well,
it's a psychological sort of a disorder, transphobia or something.
Yeah. Well, this is such a crucial thing, the manipulation and the abuse of language. Mm-hmm. If we go back to the Kabbalah, I think there, in a certain sense, there are sort of maybe three or four, like you could say, like synagogue superpowers. One of them is compound interest. One of them is the manipulation of language, because by changing language, you can change reality.
Well, I mean, if she just retorted saying you're a pervert and a groomer, that changes the tone of the debate. It puts the onus back on this individual who's arguing for this perverse, you know, demonic agenda. So when you just call them groomers, you know, you're a predator, you're a groomer. That's why they reacted so harshly to it. That's why groomer, if you use the word groomer on, I think it was on Twitter or Facebook, where you got banned if you used that. Because it made it so simple. It cut through all the BS, and there it is. Why do you want to go after the children? You know, but the children perhaps are a bridge too far. The problem is they've legitimized this thing as if it's okay if you're adults, but it's not okay if you're doing it, you're an adult. You know, it's perverse. It's weird. It's demonic. You know, but yeah, you do. It's almost like you say, it's a humiliation ritual just to have to be forced to engage in the debate in the first place. You lose just by having to engage in the debate. Because you're arguing over comments like reality. If you engage in a for a debate, what 2 + 2 equals? Why am I doing this? Why am I even doing this? Yeah.
Yes. So something that is important here. So as you say, to reframe it, for the right to reframe it, reframe the debate and talk about groomers. Say, no, it's not that you're talking about whether drag queens should have the right to read stories to children. It's no, you are groomers targeting them. That's a good reframing. It's very rare that you see the right ever doing that, because they're not allowed to. And obviously, as you say, there was significant coercion and intimidation to stop that tactic, because ultimately the regime controls the framing. And that's why the regime always wins. So with regard to the what I was saying about Lex Fridman and the sort of the artificial creation of these figures, I think it would be remiss not to mention Unit 8200 here, because we have to ask, who are these people? And Unit 8200, this unit within the IDF, has a large number of alumni, quote unquote. By the way, 90% of people at Unit 8200 work there for less than 5 years. Although I imagine that once you work there for life. But they go on to create these tech companies that frequently maintain their ties to Israeli intelligence. And according to Israeli media reports, and former employees often blur the line between their service to Israel's defense intelligence apparatus and their commercial activity. Now, I would say they're just one and the same thing. Mint Press studied a number of employment databases from US tech companies and ascertained that hundreds of agents from Israeli military intelligence and spying organization Unit 8200 are now employed in influential roles in many of the world's largest tech and communications companies, including Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon. The private security agency Black Cube, very sinister sort of secret society, has Unit 8200 alumni as its leaders. And they were caught attempting to undermine the Iran nuclear deal, which was a priority of Netanyahu at the time, by attempting to obtain information on the financial and sexual impropriety, basically for blackmail purposes, of top US officials, and I think possibly Cardinal McCarrick as well. That's something you've discussed with our friend Dr. Jesse Russell. So yeah, they have the means, the motive, the opportunity for this kind of manipulation of the dissident and alternative media space.
So what you're saying with this Unit 8200, which is a part of the Israeli Defense Force, they work there for a few years, then they go private, and they'll branch out into all these tech companies. But of course, these are Israeli intelligence agents or assets. And so what happens is you have hundreds, if not thousands, of them strewn throughout, assigned to, well, whether it's Google or Facebook or telecommunication companies, but they're also agents of the Israeli state. So basically, and so what happens is the communications, financial network, they're compromised by agents of a foreign state, Israel. But we can't point that out because they're Jewish. And if you say they're, you know, the fact that they're Jewish is something to consider, it's anti-Semitic. So you can't do that. Again, it's again a problem of a category thing. We're not given allowed to think of Jews as a group, as an organized group. But if the Russians or the Chinese had a similar program, Fox News would be all over it. You know, we do hear about the Chinese and they're buying, giving money to, Ivy League schools or buying a property. I think it was just recently the governor of Florida is proposing a law preventing the purchase of property by Chinese, the Communist Party of China. So we're allowed to identify that group, but we can't identify Jews as a group because at one point they are a group, but in another instance they're not a group; they're just individuals. So
it's part again that Kabbalah, something is and isn't at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's abolishing the law of non-contradiction, which is a crucial part of the kind of magic that they want to work, this sort of alchemical process. As you've said before, dual loyalty, which would be an improvement at this stage. But, you know, what do you think, Tim? Should we give a shout out to all the boys in the Tel Aviv computer room who are monitoring this channel now?
So, yeah, I mean, it is. Yeah, I mean, it is. Again, you point this out. The best case that highlights this was the pardoning of Jonathan Pollard.
Right.
When Jews, American Jews, advocated on behalf of his pardon, And I asked somebody, evidently to powerful Jews, Jonathan Pollard, his the fact he was Jewish mattered more than he was American. Because Jonathan Pollard sold secrets to Israel, that then passed it on to the Soviets at the time, I think, when he was caught. So, but the fact that he was apparently one of the more, I guess, the most egregious case of espionage spying, his Jewishness mattered more. And he was, again, he gave secrets to the, he gave to the Soviets. But when he returned to Israel, or when he went to Israel in 2021, because Donald Trump pardoned him, he received a hero's welcome in Tel Aviv with Benjamin Netanyahu. But if he betrayed the United States and received a hero's welcome in Israel, obviously the Israel and the Jews think of him as he's a Jewish hero who betrayed America. So what are their priorities? You know,
Tim, you either have union of church and state, or you're going to have union of synagogue and state.
Mm-hmm.
After the incarnation, it's either one or the other. Right? That is the meta history here. And what we've seen since particularly the French Revolution, going further back, the Protestant Revolution, is the apostasy of the formerly Christian nations of the West. And Pope Leo XIII drew a hylomorphic analogy where he said that the church is to the state as the soul is to the body. And what happens when soul and body are split?
Yeah, well, and in 1890, the Catholic Church wrote about that in Civita Cattolica, writing about the French Revolution, that the alienation or the forsaking of Christ led to France being ruled by Jews. And that's what the Catholic Church said in 1890. And of course, it would call for the conversion of the Jews, those integral societies were smashed in the 18th and 19th century with the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, and now we're given to believe that our republics and our constitutions are going to protect us, that's sovereign, that there are no, I guess you could say, scheming powers that could infiltrate and take it over and subvert it. Well, obviously that's not the case. Look all around us today. But that liberal order is very susceptible to infiltration and control, because there's a vacuum there that was created in the wake of the French Revolution. America's always had this problem, you know.
No, America, it's a big theological lie.
Yes,
even to even claim to make that conceit that there can be religious neutrality, mm-hmm. because religious neutrality is itself. To say that the truths of divine revelation just aren't certain enough to mm-hmm. be the basis of public law and public policy, which is to have a position with regard to the revelation of our Lord Jesus Christ, namely to reject it, which is a theological position, which is a religious position. And at that point, the body politic is then susceptible to being taken possession of by another spirit, and unfortunately that's the revolutionary spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So to move from the profound to something utterly banal and petty, I'm going to touch now on Prince Harry and his American mistress, Meghan. She's not his wife, that she's a divorcee, she's still married, marriage is indissoluble. The woman that he lives with. Now, this whole melodrama is so trivial. It's beneath consideration, really. But it's had round the clock GB News, Daily Mail, Telegraph coverage in this country. I think it's had quite a bit of coverage in the United States as well. I've started to suspect now that there's something artificial to this whole dispute that's occurring between Harry and the palace and the House of Windsor. again, if we think of the backdrop, we've got this ongoing pauperization of the middle class, right? Standards of living are falling for the first, well, not for the first time, but are very clearly falling. And they need things, they need these confected melodrama to distract people. And so rather than talking about, you know, 14-year-olds dying of cardiac arrests and the aborning police state and so on, they're talking, and the, you know, inflation and so on, they're talking about these sordid details of Prince Harry's biography, things talking about his lost virginity, how he mm-hmm. and his frostbitten penis. It's just, again, it's humiliating. It's squalid, and it strikes me. I mean, here's a quote from the book. This is about his alleged fight, physical fight with his brother, the heir to the throne, Prince William. He says, "It all happened so fast, so very fast. He grabbed me by the collar, ripping my necklace, and he knocked me to the floor. I landed on the dog's bowl, which cracked under my back, the pieces cutting into me." Now, is that something that any heterosexual man would say? You know, ripping my necklace. The whole thing just strikes me as so contrived and so implausible. This transformation that Harry has purportedly undergone from being this war veteran, this Apache helicopter pilot, to this kind of now this soy boy, Beyonce just texted, you know, representation of woke, is to me just strikes me as artificial. It's too quick. And so my hypothesis is that the Sussexes, they've been crafted as a kind of culture wars lightning rod, these kind of as part of this Punch and Judy show, to focus, again, if we think of our population segments, they've been designed to focus particularly conservative boomer energy on an utterly trivial and meaningless non-issue, while the architectonic controlled demolition continues and accelerates. There's been questions about whether to debate in Parliament, stripping Harry of his title. I mean, these incredibly, banal thing, absorbing all this attention. Let me just play another quick excerpt here. This is what I think that here, this suggests the metapolitical purpose.
What about in America, David? Do you think the Americans, I believe that the tide is even turning over there now. Yes. They've always been very supportive of him.
Well, a group hat. Remember, Harry corresponds to pretty much Democrat versus Republican, yeah. Democrats in favor. And here it is Remainers, at least young ones, loved Harry. And, you know, wicked leavers like me and probably you.
I was a Remainer, but now I'm a leaver.
I'm getting as confused as Harry. And in other words, it was Remainers who loved him, and Leavers who hated him. So in other words, it's exactly the same divide. And in America, remember, he became a kind of gospel boy. He became a front for woke.
So that was on GB News, which is this recently started sort of controlled opposition Fox News equivalent here in the United Kingdom. That was an academic, Dr. David Starkey. And what he was saying there was sort of suggestive, I think, of how they want to kind of sublimate this ridiculous squabble into the culture wars. Anyone who would be potentially opposing to the New World Order, they can focus on that rather than these substantial issues which are changing the world. Someone pointed out that when Harry was back for the Queen's funeral in September, he was seen on camera speaking quite animatedly and quite gregarious, quite, you know, in a friendly manner with his brother at that point. And he's claiming this is, you know, following their, you know, physical altercation between the two. I mean, it's just so bizarre and so implausible, and the details have been put out so sordid, as I say, that it just strikes me as has this kind of whiff of artificiality to it.
Yeah, and so much energy is spent in time debating his relationship with his brother, but it has no impact on, say, public policies or things that are going on that are literally leading to the immiseration of the public. You know, like a good example is, you know, the war in Ukraine that has been fomented by the United States and its NATO allies. They're flirting with nuclear brinkmanship. And the process, they're driving up energy prices, which is a pretext or an excuse for further immiseration and impoverishment, which then we're told it's necessary because the consumer economy has to go the way of the dodo. We have to be brought into to Klaus Schwab's new, what does he call it again? The Great Reset?
Yeah, sort of rebranded NWO. Yeah.
And no, very little attention, although some attention in the alternative media is been given to the World Economic Forum. It's got more attention than it has in the past few years because of some of its outlandish positions and statements. But, you know, they have to bring in an army of 5,000 troops to protect it. And no one asks who's paying for that, by the way. Is this a public-private partnership? The World Economic Forum, and they have all these leaders going there discussing the virtues of censorship and these things, and how we have to and preaching the same stuff about environment. They're calling it the climate crisis now. I heard one speech, one lady, it looked like she was Indian. She said that if we don't address the climate crisis now, more than half of the planet will live in uninhabitable areas. Well, does it make those areas habitable?
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to actually maybe even interpret something like that as a threat, and not discount this idea of geoengineering. Maybe climate change. I don't believe maybe anthropogenic climate change is true, not in the way that they're claiming with carbon emissions. These geoengineering events, and they will actually engineer some kind of climate catastrophe.
Yeah, it also becomes an excuse for mass weaponized migration.
Yeah,
because they're saying these things are inevitable. In the past, they've used civil wars or wars that they create and foment as an excuse for refugee crises, and then they can say the climate and the same thing in Africa or something, or. They have to relocate, 5 million people from West Africa or the Horn of Africa to Ireland for some reason. And if you oppose that, you're a racist.
Mm. One of the things that is mentioned in the protocols, and I don't know the authenticity of those, but interesting to read in a sort of the Machiavellian sense, is how. Goys find it difficult to consider how the chosen people do things for multiple reasons. That Gentiles do things for one or two reasons, but the special people do things maybe four or five reasons, and that's almost like beyond the kind of consideration of most people.
This is why in the past in society where this was acknowledged that you had laws or restrictions to the chosen people, because without any restraints or restrictions, they would manipulate the situation and engage all in various levels of cultural aggression and economic exploitation, and then engage in all types of clever justifications for these things. And that's what we see in the West today.
Well, without the faith, without the one true faith, the synagogue can just run all over the Gentiles. That's mentioned again in the protocols. They say that the Jesuits are above us. The Jesuits are our equal. They have the intellectual perspicacity to understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. But once the Jesuits are taken out, and once we secularize the West, then we'll be able to manipulate.
Well, because it no longer has the protection of Christ.
Yes, yeah, sin darkens the intellect.
Yeah, and what is? I mean, you can say, well, is it God's protection? Call it wisdom, practical reason, morality. These things, these all stem from a religious faith and an understanding of reality. And you deny yourself that, and you're right. It sin darkens the mind, and it makes you, and you know, lust makes you stupid, as you can see. Which is why you have all these debates about lust issues. You know.
Yeah.
You know. That's why we have entire months, well, actually the entire year now, really, but they, like in the United States, June is, you know, Gay Pride Month, and the whole month is celebrated to, you know, celebrating one of the seven deadly sins. They combine lust and pride, you know, two of the seven deadly sins.
Yeah, exactly. And talking of lust, we have this new character that's emerged on stage, this new controlled opposition character, Andrew Tate, who has been all over the media, both alternative and mainstream. He's a pornographer. He's a prostitution, a pimp, a man who sells women, and which is the least masculine thing you can imagine, the least virtuous. He presents women as objects. He resides in Romania.
Men are supposed to protect women and children,
right?
Not exploit. Exactly.
Yeah, that if you want to get down to like what is masculinity, it's strength for weakness.
Mm-hmm.
That the core, you know, qualities of being a man are protection, provision, procreation, and primacy. The mm-hmm. four P's. And we are given that masculine strength and that intellectual privilege to serve God and to serve our neighbor and to protect women and to protect children. And so the fact that he is being promoted as this kind of paragon of masculinity is disgusting shows the kind of dialectic again that they want to offer. You either be the Prince Harry Beyonce just texted soy boy, or you be the Andrew Tate.
Yes.
Tattooed, cigars, supercars, use women, cad type. Those are the only two options. Virtuous masculinity, the chivalrous knight, that's excluded. That's not an option. Just like for women, you either have the prostitute type, or you have the frigid mm-hmm. feminist ball cutter type. And there's no virtuous woman type that's an option. So something that an interlocutor of mine, someone I've had on Vonday Radio, Michael Jonah of Nineveh, has talked about is this idea of adversity marketing. That when you hear about someone being banned and it's getting a lot of coverage, that actually generates a lot of publicity and actually can generate a lot of interest, again, from that dissident segment of the population who they know to cater for. That this creates adversity marketing. Interesting to say. And Tate has had all this kind of mainstream media coverage about him being banned here, banned there, appearing on Piers Morgan, on InfoWars dozens of times, on Tucker Carlson, who, by the way, recently came out in support of gay marriage, on Michaela Peterson, who's Jordan Peterson's daughter. She used to work at the United Nations, kind of interesting. GB News. And you've studied, deep politics for long enough, Tim, to know that when they don't want something out there, they don't ban you and then give you publicity about the banning, right? They just ban you and give you dynamic silence,
mm-hmm.
right? They just shut you down. And psychologically, the opposite of love isn't hate. The opposite is indifference. And so when there's something they really hate, they just draw deprive it of the oxygen of publicity. So we can see here that Tate is being astroturfed, and recently he's had this ridiculous fake beef, quote unquote, with Greta Thunberg.
Yes, another creation.
Yeah, she's a creation for the Globo Homo left. And she recently had a staged arrest by police in Germany as well. So they've got all these characters for these different population segments. Here's another audio clip from Andrew Tate.
Of Andrew Tate here, thought it was kind of interesting.
Father, when he died, someone messaged me who was in, because my father was in the CIA. He held the CIA record for the fastest assimilation of a foreign language. My father learned Russian within 2.5 weeks from Duro Mario. And we were sitting, and I was sitting with my father, who spoke fluent Russian. My father spoke Russian fluently. He learned Russian in the Air Force. He was a linguist for the Air Force. In fact, he was intelligence. He worked in CIA. Long story. Anyway.
So there we go. You know, from the horse's mouth, we've got there clearly a connection. His father literally worked for the CIA. It's a very classic background for someone to work in language in one of the other branches of the armed forces and then get into the intelligence agencies. Clearly, and then this business of him living in Romania, conducting his pornographic lifestyle. That's as you've touched on before, Eastern Europe generally is a hotspot of human trafficking, which the intelligence agencies are deeply part of. So I would say that Andrew Tate, he has this meta purpose to mislead, misguide and contain and distort truth for young men in particular, and functions as this agent provocateur, which itself generates outrage from the globo homo left with the genuinely misogynistic things he says and so on. And so that they can then paint those on the right that are hostile to globo homo as these barbarians and so on that need to have the weight, the full weight of the totalitarian state come down on them.
Yeah, I mean, you get this cartoonish figure like Andrew Tate, whereas this presentation masculinity is a kickboxer. He can kick anyone's ass, that sort of thing, as if that's the true expression of masculinity. And this is womanizing consumption and these things. Who does that serve? If you look at it, what agenda? Whose agenda is he serving by appealing to that? Now you could say it's also how much of this is emergent behavior, because if you create a society which punishes traditional masculinity, traditional role models, and these things, what's the incentive for to men to fill those roles? There isn't any. With women behaving badly, why should men behave well? You know, and so they've created this dialectic. But yet, now, of course, he's portrayed as, or he poses as, someone who's successful, wealthy, and these things. And he's 36 years old, and I guess he's bragged about fathering children out of wedlock. Again, this is just, society can't be based on that. Society, if men behave like Andrew Tate, society collapses, you know. And just like, same way that if women behave like Gloria Steinem or something, because society collapses.
Yeah, well said, Tim. And as I abhor feminism very, very strongly, but we must acknowledge that men apostatize first. If men won't put themselves under our Lord Jesus Christ, then women won't put themselves under men. And what we saw in the 18th and 19th century was man rejecting God. Mm-hmm. And then in the 20th century, women rejected men's authority. And it won't recover until men recover authentic Christian virtue.
Well, it's servant leadership, right?
Servant leadership, and follow the way of the master. That's most perfectly fulfilled by our Lord and his sacrifice.
You know, if you conduct yourself in a way that doesn't compromise your moral authority, you'll have that authority. And just if men were corrupted, I guess you could say pornography and sex and these things, but if you, that's what, where they knew if you undermine those first, you could upend society, and they have, with the promotion with Wilhelm Reich or Freud, Hollywood, using movies and music, and they've done that all for the better part of a century now.
As you put it so well, Tim, you can't have public order while you have internal disorder.
No, because so one stems from the other. Public, yeah.
If you want to create public disorder in order to realize the anti-Christendom, then you're going to create public internal disorder first. And the word virtue, vir, is Latin for man. It literally means manliness. So if you talk about manly virtues, you're saying manliness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how intimately, you know, tied, you know, that how essential male the life of virtue is for the commonweal as well. Now, Tate has a strange connection to another very prominent controlled opposition figure, Dr. Jordan Peterson. Peterson has this daughter, I've mentioned, Michaela Peterson, who's got her own podcast and kind of attacks, again, the trans juggernaut while not attacking the roots of that juggernaut, not attacking feminism and so on. She had some strange connection, you know, I don't want to speculate, but with Andrew Tate. Peterson, a lot of people have commented on how he's become a much more overtly controlled opposition in the last couple of years following this mysterious illness and this trip to Russia. And I think that it's quite possible that, again, with this Unit 8200 observation of the currents within Western social political discourse, they've noticed the prominence of someone like Dr. E. Michael Jones. And so Jordan Peterson is being set up to kind of sideswipe E. Michael Jones as the kosher approved alternative, talking about the Logos. That's a major theme for Jordan Peterson, but it never actually explicitly directs one towards baptism and the becoming an adopted son of God and living the life of a Christian. Instead, it's this kind of vague, Gnostic kind of babble a lot of the time. So here's a famous recent clip from Jordan Peterson that I'm going to play.
As Jews in Israel, are you telling the greatest story ever told? Well, you decide that by how you live. And that decision will affect the world because everyone looks here for one reason or another. It's not so easy to understand. Everyone looks here to see, well, how are you actually doing under this tremendous assault of adversarial criticism as this little tiny people in the middle of no man's land in some real sense as a, what would you say, cardinal model of the nation state and the city on the hill. You have a tremendous moral responsibility like you have perhaps for your entire history for reasons that are very difficult to understand. And I think it is true in some real sense that the fate of the world depends on the decisions of the people of Israel, just as the fate of the world depends. Just as the fate of the world depends on the decision of every individual. So you make yourself a shining light on the hill, right? You attract people here because of what you're capable of doing. You show the world what the holy city could look like, because we need it. We need it, and it's up to you to do it.
So there's Dr. Peterson collecting his shekels in Jerusalem earlier last year.
What's the greatest story ever told?
Well, to keep bursting into tears.
Isn't that Jesus Christ?
Yeah, it's since his joining the Daily Wire, which you mentioned earlier, it's become so obvious to anyone, you know, who can check the YouTube comment section or read a Twitter comments about the artificial nature of Peterson's public prominence, and how his role seems to be to herd young, often fatherless men into this sort of Zionist controlled right-wing space while policing the boundaries of that space to ensure that any more threatening questions to the regime are not asked. For instance, in November, he tweeted, "The anti-Semites are truly starting to climb back out of hell's sewer. Appalling to observe." He's posted, as you mentioned on his on the Daily Wire, an interview with the notorious sodomite Dave Rubin, who is hiring out a woman's body to have his surrogate child, with a number, you know, having killed a number of fetuses in order to achieve that implantation.
What is Dave Rubin's relationship to Logos?
You're right. Yeah, it's. I've got a. I'm thinking of actually just doing a commentary video on that deeply unappetizing discussion between Rubin and Peterson. But you can see that what they're trying to do is sort of bring the LGB into the conservative movement. You can be against the T for now, but the LGB, and they at one point they even say, trans is bad because it's a threat to gay kids.
Gay kids. That's a legitimate category.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the neurolinguistic programming homosexual, same-sex attracted kids might be at risk of being mutilated by a sex change operation because authority figures will identify them as trans when actually they're just gay or something like it. It's the most vomit-worthy stuff. But
these are the people that claim the mantle of science too, right?
Yeah, exactly, and they're in prominent leadership positions. But I think he's taken a hit in his popularity, thankfully. During COVID, he famously said, "Just take the damn vaccine." So that event, as you've spoken about at length, it was incredibly revelatory to be able to adduce which figures were particularly malicious, controlled opposition. Recently, Peterson's interviewed Netanyahu for the Israeli intelligence link platform, The Daily Wire. Let's listen to a clip.
The Israelis, the Jews, have done a tremendous amount of work in improving this territory. And I know there's a principle of ownership in Western common law, in English common law. And I'm not a lawyer, so I may muck this up to some degree, but I understand the principle. If you own territory, a vast swath of land, and you're doing nothing to it, and someone comes and squats on it and spends a lot of time improving it, at some point they actually develop a valid legal claim to the property itself. And so there seems to be something intrinsic to our notion of valid ownership, that if you're going to occupy a territory, you actually have to do something with it that's productive. And so that's at least part of the claim you're making at the moment, to buttress the notion that the Jewish people have a valid claim to the present territory.
Well, and
there are a lot of movement back and forth.
Yes,
but the Jews have actually taken the land and made something of it.
Well, I'm saying something else. I'm saying that they held the land for 2,000 years, were kicked out. The Arabs came and conquered it and immediately lost it to others and did nothing with it. The others did nothing with it. So it was basically, they took over my apartment, okay, a long time ago. The guys who took over basically kicked me out, were kicked out themselves. The apartment was left barren. And many decades, in this case, centuries later, I come back to this barren mess, okay, this ruin, and I build it up back. And I not only improve it, I not only make my ownership based on improvement, but that nobody else did anything with it. There was no someone else. There practically were no tenants.
Right.
That's my argument.
Right.
So there we go. The Mohammedan and Christian Palestinian residents of the Holy Land weren't doing anything with it prior to the Israeli, the Jewish appropriation.
This was land. The myth of the land without a people for a people without a land.
Right.
But so who do they in the Napika, who do they chase out? Who do they I think they killed, you know, thousands of people and chased out hundreds of thousands. So what were they doing? And what's the West Bank and Gaza Strip then?
Well, they're building a shining city on the hill, Tim. And I think this is the sort of meta political purpose, perhaps, of someone like Peterson. There's a website called Fitz Info, which has got collected a number of commentary and videos and so on Peterson that the viewers, the listeners could access. But there's a bit of speculation from some people there that he's there to kind of promote the Noahide laws, and that we've got this left wing of the world order, the Globo Homo side, which is just going flat out pedal to the metal in the direction of the dissolution and destruction of formerly Christian civilization, what's left. But then we've got this right wing side, which in a sense is much more interesting because it compartmentalizes the truth and presents some of it. And by doing so, it creates trust. But it seems to be moving towards perhaps this kind of promotion of these Talmudic seven Noahide laws to the Gentile populations, and this kind of vague focus on logos that I've mentioned is here as well. I'm going to be talking to a man who's been doing study of the Kabbalah and this sort of alchemical, dialectical, esoteric process, Will Tucker. So perhaps listeners could look out for that in a couple of weeks if they want to hear more about this esoteric side of things. But I think one of the things he's going to talk about is how they're sort of creating this kind of Atlanticist Leviathan versus this Eurasian behemoth. And Israel, interestingly, is sort of playing both sides. You mentioned about some of the spying from Israeli citizens in the United States. And often that intelligence seems to end up in the hands of the Russians and the Chinese as well. Things like military technology as well. And there's people have speculated there's going to be some kind of big architectonic shift where the United States basically suffers controlled demolition with the collapse of the dollar, and the hegemon gets set up as this kind of Eurasianist bloc, the dollar is kind of dethroned, and Israel's right at the center of that. I mean, I don't know, this is just sort of speculation, but I think we're going to experience some very dramatic times in the next few months, few years. But I think if you want to get to the heart of it, it is this kind of alchemical or sorcerous process. And that touches on the metapolitics of what I've said, you know, choosing Greta Thunberg or Andrew Tate, excluding Christianity. And the thing is that as Aristotle pointed out in the Rhetoric, you know, what creates power within discourse, within rhetoric, are three things: ethos, pathos, and logos, the rhetorical triangle. And what the regime seems to permit is maybe a figure to emerge with one of those, or even two of them, but never all three at once. So for example, Tate, his ethos, he's this very cartoonish machismo ethos that has its appeal because masculinity is so attacked by the Globo Homo side of the world order. His logos, okay, he's talking about against the COVID scamdemic and so on, that's good. And his pathos is delivered with real feeling, but then it's mixed in with you know, cursing and vulgarities and vice and so on. Peterson is talking about with some logos, but it's not fulfilled. His ethos, he seems to be a family man, but his daughter's kind of going off the rails, lots of immodest images and so on. And his pathos, well, he keeps bursting into tears, which seems to suggest something isn't psychologically or spiritually right there. So in other words, if we had a Charlemagne, if we had, you know, a Saint Francis, if we had a Saint Dominic, if we had a Simon de Montfort, if we had a King Saint Louis IX who combined Christian ethos, logos, and pathos, then they wouldn't stand a chance. And so that's why they kind of play on those, with these figures who are never allowed to fulfill all three of those.
Yeah, and they kind of meet the immediate demand or appetite for what comes across as sort of a refreshing opinion or something. Jordan Peterson is a good example of that one. Early on, when he started taking on the low hanging fruit of feminism, you know, debating some of these bird brains, and said, "Oh yeah, it sounds good," but again, the moment you get look at if any depth, he falls apart. And that's when you're talking about logos. There he is. He's standing in front of that. What is he at a thesis or something? Where the library there? So he must.
Yeah, it's very glossy. It's, yeah. Again, like the kind of the ethos, like the way they present it. The presentation is very slick. The substance is very shallow.
Oh yeah, especially when he's referring to Israel and that history there. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu, I think he's Ashkenazi, which means he's Turkic. He doesn't have any genetic relationship to that area, if that means anything. And also the whole idea of Israel. The new Israel, of course, is a Catholic church. It isn't Israel. Because with Jesus Christ, you had supersession. And Judaism became obsolete. And it became revolutionary because of a rejection of Christ and rejection of Logos. So he's speaking about Logos to a group that overtly rejects Logos, you know, properly understood.
Again, these are the rhetorical tricks that are played, but the equivocation on the words Israel, the equivocation on the words Jew, the equivocations on all these fundamental concepts are a key part of their power play. As you say, there is the church and there is the synagogue, and the church is the new Israel. And so for the church men today, the hierarchy, to surrender and to recognize the state of Israel as such is a terrible surrender on that front, and creates all this confusion. But I think, you know, again, it's worth considering this is the background that we're thinking of, this you know, accelerating controlled demolition and collapse, with the currency debasement, with the money power and its creation of credit, the banks creating the money supply, and then all these signs, the debt and demographics, principally, that what Alexis de Tocqueville said, that the American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money. Mm-hmm. You know, the consequence of that is being forming before our eyes.
Well, just recently, the Saudis said they might start selling oil in other currencies.
Right,
which is
so that's part of this Eurasianist transition.
Yeah. Petrodollar now. You know, could they? I mean, and that, of course, Harry and Meghan get more press than that. And you look at, well, who's our Treasury Secretary of the United States? So it's Janet Yellen. She's Jewish. And you have a look at the U.S. sanction regime. I think it was like 40% of the world global population is under U.S. sanction. And of course, the people that run the sanction office are all Jewish. But that sanction office is also leading to the de-dollarization of the global economy, because people have to establish, you know, like the BRIC nations, they have to establish workarounds. And this whole Ukrainian mess is also leading to the de-dollarization, you know, because, again, people have to establish workarounds. And it does seem like a plan, because it's so the policies are so irresponsible and reckless, incompetent. That they incompetence can't be an explanation here.
Yeah. Exactly so. So we have this kind of what David Hawke calls this anti-trinity, that defines postmodernity of usury, sodomy, and idolatry. And they're all manifestations of this general war on logos that permeates all postmodern culture. So I said that at the beginning of this program that there are signs of hope. And what I mean is that through where evil abounds, grace abounds all the more, and that God brings good out of evil. And so that's the note that I'd maybe like to finish my comments on, is that with all of this becoming more manifest, I am encouraged by seeing more people converting, more people living lives of grace, and people realizing more and more, despite all this, these attempts at controlling discourse, controlling the narrative, people are finding things out, and they are more and more cooperating with the graces they receive, the prevenient graces, and starting to see that there is that the spiritual is primary, and that there is no political solution without a spiritual solution first.
Yeah, and you're seeing that in places like Ireland, you know, where they've were alienated or they forsake their faith and they're taken over. I understand there's a resurgence of church attendance in Ireland. I haven't witnessed it, but I'm told that it might be because of the chastening they're getting now. And so people are realizing, you know, that the globalization and the Irish tiger seduction that was purchased with debt, you know, was a con. And and so the false promises of liberalism, materialism, these things, people are realizing that it only comes down to they need a spiritual revival, because again, you can't have a spirit, you can't lack that belief and have live a fulfilled life, and the West is a great example of that.
Yeah, and win heaven. You know, this life ultimately is,
yeah,
what is it, for, you know, 4 score years and 10, 3 score years and 10, and there, you know, it's nothing to an eternity, either as a dying as a friend of God, enjoying the beatific vision, you know, eternal bliss, or eternal torment and perdition for those that die in God's disgrace. And that's where so many of these wicked figures are heading.
That's the ultimate distraction, isn't it?
Yeah, because paganism relies on the fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
And the resurrection destroys paganism, undoes the logic of paganism by showing us that we need not be afraid of death, that our Lord has conquered death. And so, as you say, by spreading liberalism, materialism, they have Western man has apostatized, and he's re-paganized to become fearful of death again. And we saw that, of course, during the COVID pseudo pandemic.
People were so afraid of death that they stopped living.
Yeah, and they're willing to become slaves.
Yeah,
willing to become slaves ultimately, and the revolutionary social order can only be based on fear, and that fear is the oligarchs and the devil's greatest power. It's a fear that we give them, whereas the Christian social order is based on justice and charity. And so I see a future where we experience more and more material hardship and privation, which is a good thing, because that's what's actually waking people up to the sunshine of God's love in their life, and those trends that you've noticed, that we've both noticed, will accelerate as a result.
Well, the overabundance, if you will, the distractions, the toys and baubles that distract us, that's been the source of our torment.
Yeah.
You know, that's the source of the error. And so, yes, so you're going to, I mean, there's going to have to be a correction. And unfortunately, yeah, I mean, I like to see it, you know, again, unfortunately, people don't respond to these things. You need a crisis. You need something to get their attention.
They need to be taken away.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, it'd be nice if you could avoid any suffering in these, but that's, you know, that's not how it's going to play out. It's not something that I look forward to or I ask for, I'm just acknowledging the situation.
The church priest is redemptive suffering.
Yeah.
And that by suffering we actually share, we can participate in Christ's suffering. As St. Paul says, you know, make up the suffering that is lacking in Christ. It doesn't mean that there was anything imperfect about Christ's sacrifice, but it means that we participate in his redemptive work in time and space. And this is where the Protestants are wrong to say that, sola fide, salvation by faith alone. In fact, salvation is a synergy between faith and graced works that we achieve, that we work through God's grace that he gives us. And that's our participation.
And I mean, much of the insanity that we're witnessing, sort of the transgender stuff, this is just the reductio ad absurdum of liberalism itself. The idea, what is that? There was something, there was some news story, transgender issue. And it's like, is there anything more American than telling, people being anything they want to be or becoming anything you want to be? And then demanding under penalty of law that everyone else, indulge your delusion. And that's what we're doing today. It's like, well, no, you can't be anything you want to be. It's not, there is biology and these things like that. Things biology, that's a physical reality, a truth we have to acknowledge. But it's a physical truth that reveals divine truth. Sort of a Thomistic way of looking at these things, that we can infer a divine truth by looking at the physical reality. They're denying obvious physical realities at this point. It's just a natural progression of things, and they're going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing until there's a reaction.
As you say, it's the inexorable logic of liberalism.
Yeah,
an unfolding of the inner logic of liberalism, which itself is the political expression of a deeper philosophical error that you've touched on there, which is nominalism, the idea that things have no nature. So there is no such thing as a male nature or female nature, or the truth of the essence of particular bodies or objects that we encounter in the world.
That's one of the mistakes coming out of Great Britain, right?
William of Ockham. Right? Yeah. I'm afraid England has not covered herself in virtue in the modern era. I'm afraid we are responsible for so much of the afflictions and pathologies that have affected Christian civilization, both nominalism and liberalism. And capitalism. This is a real problem. Pragmatism as well. Nominalism really lies at the heart of liberalism, because liberalism denies, it first of all begins in a false anthropology. So it denies that man is a political and social animal, which is always the Christian understanding, but also the classical realist understanding, going back to Aristotle, whereas liberalism conceives of man, because there's no such thing as human nature, because natures have been denied because of nominalism, it conceives of man as purely atomized individual material substances that are just colliding, that just happen to collide with
which can be manipulated and altered, right?
Which exactly
through the intellect. That's what transhumanism is. Naval Harari and all these. Now, happiness is just a chemical thing. So you just give people drugs, create happy, they'll be happy, as opposed to the conditions that make them truly happy. And that's why they're talking the way they do. But it all goes back again. He's saying that man will become God through technology, which just goes back, takes us back to the Garden of Eden.
Yep.
The false promise.
Well, again, this is where it gets to the Kabbalah, because their kind of hidden doctrines, the kind of heart of the synagogue's revolutionary spirit, is that there were two Torahs, that there was there's the tradition, there's the revelation of God on Mount Sinai to Moses, but then there was also an oral revelation, which was the negation of the commandments that were given, the mitzvah. So again, it's this kind of dialectical process, but it's this idea that the first revelation, which was written on tablets of stone, which Moses then broke with the worshipping of the Hebrews of the golden calf, was replaced by a second revelation. And it's this antinomianism, basically, this attack on law, which and then you have the Tree of Life as represented by the Sephirot in the Zohar, and this idea of like undoing reality, basically like breaking open reality to access the divine spark that has been fragmented into reality at creation. I mean, this is really how stupid it is, but that's why there's this attack on the Platonic forms, man, woman, mm-hmm. pandemic, yeah. These underlying, forms that had truth to them. They're just being evacuated of their meaning for this occult purpose.
Yeah, so they think they can just alter a definition in the dictionary and that changes the reality.
Yeah, it's nominalism, just names. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, okay. I think we covered it.
Yes, I think so. Yes. It's been a real pleasure, Tim, as always. And if readers are interested in some of the things, listeners are interested in some of the things I've touched on, then please check out my channel, Vonde Radio, you will. Be able to hear a number of interviews where I explore some of these topics further.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. I'll let you go. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Thank you, Tim.
Okay. God bless. Take care. Bye-bye.
Viva Cristo Rey.